A blockchain is the worst possible way to do virtually anything. It's an awful way to do almost everything, with a few exceptions. And the things it does well, it does so extraordinarily well that there's no equal to it.
Hey, I hope you're having a good week as always. So this episode is an epic one with truly one of the smartest people in the room. William Quigley is the co-founder of Tether, aka the first fiat-backed stablecoin and most traded cryptocurrency to date, and the co-founder of Wax, one of the most used blockchains in the world with over 10 million active users and 20 million transactions per day. Before that, he was the first institutional investor in PayPal, a very early supporter of Ethereum, worked at Disney, and was CEO of the world's largest marketplace for video game virtual items. His career and ability to consistently predict and execute on the next major trends is really incredible, and this episode is full of some really brilliant insights. We talk about his career, how he spots these trends, and what the future looks like for blockchain gaming, amongst many other things. It was an absolute pleasure recording this a few weeks back, so thank you, William, for coming on the show. As always, nothing in this episode is financial or investment advice. And with that said, let's get into it. William, great to have you on the show. Thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you.
Good stuff. So you have an incredible career, which spans across so many things, the finance and investment space in lots of ways. Also working at Disney, I read as well, and in the gaming sector, which we'll talk about, co-founding Wax Blockchain, and of course, co-founding Tether as well, which is quite the resume amongst many other things. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about your journey, just to summarize for people listening. It'd be great to hear it from you.
Oh, well, I guess you could say I started out in consulting and wound up at the Walt Disney Company. And from there, I co-founded the first consumer internet venture capital fund. And that turned out to be the perfect time to do it. It was the mid-90s, and no one was really thinking about this as being a reliable investment area, that being consumer internet. It was thought it might just be a fad, believe it or not. So my two partners and I made a lot of fantastic investments in that area. And I did a lot of things across the internet arena, from e-commerce to advertising to payments, analytics. And I would say when crypto came along, that helped me a lot, because the way we approached the investing in early stage companies during Web 1.0 was very similar to the way my partner and I did it in crypto, because we realized that there would be a layer upon layer of investment opportunities, starting with infrastructure and then going to applications and then getting into analytics and data. And so we applied the same rule book for crypto as we did with internet. While there are differences between the two, that wound up paying off a lot. I should also mention that during my venture career, I was involved in a lot of video gaming businesses, including one that my partner started, which was a marketplace for buying and selling video game virtual items. And he ultimately built the largest marketplace in the world for that. And the buying and selling, trading of video game virtual items is very similar to crypto. And in fact, a lot of early people in crypto came from my industry, the video game virtual item trading industry. And so I always felt like we had maybe a deeper insight into what people want and how they acquire these things and the difficulties of acquiring them and making sure that people are properly secure when they get their items and they custody them. All of those things were business problems we solved with video game virtual item trading that came to be very useful for crypto as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's I think it's well said, and we're going to dive into the gaming world, which continues to be the story, really, and especially the blockchain gaming space, which really feels like it is finding its feet this cycle. So we'll definitely get into that. I'm watching it very closely. Just broadly, like you've had an incredible kind of track record of spotting these opportunities till now. Is there any common themes that you kind of work towards? That? How are you able to kind of see what is coming in such a repeatable way, would you say?
Well, I've tried to synthesize that because I have teammates who I want to impart that onto, that information, that approach onto. And it is true. I've tended to be at the right place at the right time over the last 30 plus years. And I think a big part of it is that I am constantly looking at consumer phenomenons, which is where I tend to focus, and then asking myself, why are people doing that? And what's missing? And so it's almost hard for me to look at anything and not immediately kind of go through that heuristic, which can be a bit exhausting. But no matter what it is, I try to understand what's the underlying drivers for why this is popular. And of course, I've missed many, many things. But when something crosses my my path and it seems like there's a lot of enthusiasm, I tend to focus more on things where they're emerging and where maybe in the initial stages, there's a rabidly vested group of people who love something, as opposed to something's emerging and there's a lot of people who are kind of expressing lukewarm interest, right? So if there's a ton of people doing something, but it doesn't look like they're that engaged, that is less interesting to me than a very small number of people who are fanatical. And I think that's because, generally speaking, if people are fanatical, a lot more people are going to be fanatical. And it just may be the people fanatical at the beginning are that way because they saw it early, you know? And so I think the intensity at which you find a customer base attached to something is a very important variable in deciding as an investor or an entrepreneur whether you should pursue it, whether there's something there. It's going to be a big market.
That's really amazing advice. I often think that if the nerds and the kids are doing it, and I say nerds lovingly because we're all nerds about something, then you should probably take a closer look at it because they're usually onto something first. Would you agree with that broad analysis?
Yeah. I mean, young people don't have many responsibilities. So they have tons of free time. And there's a lot of experimentation. So that tends to be why a lot of trends start with young people, right? And then you also have another phenomenon, which is every generation, and that may be every 15 years or so, the newer generation doesn't want to do things the way their older brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles are doing it. And so they shift. And in that shift, there's an opportunity. And then, of course, you have the less predictable from a timing standpoint, but still incredibly valuable, periods where there's a new platform. You know, a new platform is released or developed. And now that I've been around a long time, I kind of have an approach to how I look at those things. But typically, there's a lot of tinkerers. No one knows what to do with it, but they're intrigued. And then at some point, somebody figures out that this new contraption, it allows us to do things much better than some old way of doing something. And then everybody piles in. And the biggest one, of course, in my lifetime was the internet. And that took roughly, I would say, about 10 years from the dawn of the browser, so call that 95, to about 2005 for a lot of the initial ideas that we're still riding on, for those to be identified and built on. Now, everything wasn't built by 2005, but the core thinking around what the internet could do took about 10 years. You know, it's been very different with crypto, by the way, and blockchain. I feel like on a relative scale, or in like 1997, as opposed to 2005 with blockchain. And there's a number of reasons I think for that, but it's been way slower for people to figure out what to do with blockchains.
Why do you think that is out of interest?
I've pondered this, so I don't have the answer. I just have some conjecture. But having been a young guy at the dawn of the consumer internet was much more tangible to me. What we did with it, we thought of it as a broadcast medium. And we had a lot of examples of that already in the world, which we could build upon. It was just much more tangible and, frankly, far easier to work with. At least initially, there wasn't a lot at risk with the internet, because payments and money movement on the internet didn't really happen in mass until my partners and I were the first investors, the first institutional investors in PayPal. And I would say that was the first broad scale attempt to get payments on the web and link your bank account and all that. Believe it or not, it was virtually impossible to become an authorized credit card merchant as an e-commerce guy early on. And if you did, you paid 14% of the transaction to the credit card companies. So PayPal was free for the first 3.5 years, and it was super simple. So you didn't have that scary aspect of, oh, I better be really secure and careful with my stuff. So I think there was a lot more people jumping on board because the risks were lower. And with blockchain, I think blockchains are terribly abstract to people. They are, even among people who work in the crypto space, thinking is the vast majority have no idea what a blockchain is. I mean, the vast majority, 80% plus. And it's very hard to build something using a new platform when you really don't understand what it is. You know, you can do it, and I did do it. I would say for the first 3 years or so, where I was building blockchains and then building smart contracts, I did not understand what they were. It was easy to make them, but I really didn't understand, like, what exactly is this? And for me, in the way I approach innovation, I have to really get down to the distilled essence of something. I have to really understand what are the, you know, at the atomic level, what am I working with? And that took several years. And then it finally clicked. Ah, this is what a blockchain is. These are, you know, its capabilities. And this is where it's suitable. And what I noticed was that the vast majority of people building blockchains or building applications on blockchains were building things for which a blockchain was superfluous. And so, you know, I realized, well, a lot of people probably don't realize what it is that they're getting with the blockchain. And that's why they're using it, when in fact, probably a SQL database would be more convenient. And maybe I would say even now, there's still not a great understanding of it. And that's just, it's an abstract concept. And abstract things take a lot more time for people to figure out.
Mm, it's the building in real time thing, isn't it? Where their use cases are beginning to show themselves, but people are sort of trying to find them whilst building at the same time. And I wonder as well whether some of the confusion is because we do now have the internet and the information rails. It's like both the good stuff and the bad stuff can travel faster, so it gets confusing quicker, which we never really had before. It was like you'd see it when it worked, otherwise you wouldn't see it. Whereas now it's kind of the good and the bad, you sort of see in equal measure, and it's going to become confusing. If you were to summarize, so I know some people, especially new, will be listening, and to sort of summarize what you were talking about, the sort of point of a blockchain, essentially at its core, it's a ledger and it's value transfer. But would you be able to sort of sum that up for somebody who's coming to this maybe as their first or second episode?
Yeah. So I guess I would say this. A blockchain is the worst possible way to do virtually anything. That's what I would start with. It's an awful way to do almost everything. with a few exceptions. And the things it does well, it does so extraordinarily well that there's no equal to it. And so we actually don't need blockchains to do a lot, because the few things they do marvelously. So let's just focus on those things. And when I'm working with my team and we're working on incubation ideas and whatnot, you know, I will remind them that one way to think about a blockchain is that it's a platform that allows a person to send something to a recipient where that recipient knows instantly at no cost and with no effort that the thing they're getting is genuine. Now, if you just say that's all it does, it allows you to send things to others, even anonymously, which is pretty amazing. You can anonymously send something to somebody and they know when they get it instantly, no effort, no cost, that it's genuine. That, I think, just put that in a box and there should be a million business ideas and consumer concepts that you can create from that, because nothing else like that exists in the world. And frankly, it was this realization to me that caused my partners and me to invent the stablecoin, which is just a token that is, in our case, collateralized against a US dollar, and that's called Tether. And so the reason it's a remarkable thing is because, you know, currency has a lot of problems. If it's paper, then it can be lost. It can be counterfeited. The receiver can't never really know if it's fake or real. The printer technology is advanced enough that you can fake it. And it's not very fungible, right? You can't just rip a piece of paper and say, here's a, you know, half of a euro. So what we call in blockchain tokenization, in the internet it's called digitization, but it's tokenization. Tokenizing something allows it to be put into this wrapper, this protective wrapper that ensures it's genuine and it can never be tampered with, which is one of the powers of a blockchain. You can't edit it. And so you could say if the only use case we got out of blockchain technology was the tokenization of the world's fiat currencies, then blockchains will have created trillions of dollars worth of value. And of course, there's many more things we can do with those features I described. But I think that's the best way for an entrepreneur to think about this. Just say to yourself, if I could ensure these properties, I can send it to anybody. It gets there instantly. It costs nothing. They know for sure it's genuine with no effort. I bet you they'd find a lot of opportunities that they could pursue just with those conditions.
Mm, absolutely. Well said. And I think something that I often say to new people is to go back. There's an amazing book called Broken Money, which I've mentioned before, by Lynn Alden, and just takes you back to how money and exchange and trade developed in the first instance in early settlements, and you begin to see how money develops, and then you get to Bitcoin, and then you kind of can understand, okay, well, that is money. There are other potential use cases as well, and you start to kind of understand it from the first principles, I think is my point. But yeah, really interesting.
Yes. Yeah, the first principles argument works well with this, which means, of course, that you need to be a student of this technology, you know? And one of the challenges we've had in blockchain, I think, has been the overwhelmingly pervasive use of this technical jargon. And I don't see that in other areas as a venture capitalist that I've invested in. You know, internet had ridiculous amount of complexity because you were touching the telecom network. And then the whole stack of the networking layer, right? From literally copper wire to telephone switches to Ethernet boxes and routers to modems to your computer. It was really complex, but we never talked about that, right? We just said, look at the pretty picture you can get when you open your computer. And that, it's puzzling to me. I don't really have an explanation for why, but especially in the early days of crypto, going to the conferences that popped up almost immediately, there was too much jargon. And I think jargon is very off-putting. And worse, I think jargon masks our understanding of stuff. You know, so I have always struggled to learn. You know, I always had a learning problem. And I, as a result, I always had to break things down into very simplistic pieces. And I think with blockchain, that's probably an advantage, because when you can break it down, you realize it's not complex. I would even go so far as to tell you, I don't really consider blockchains technology. I mean, they're technology in the same way like a fork or a spoon is technology. You need no computer to do a blockchain. You can do it on a piece of paper. A blockchain is just a methodology for capturing, storing, and retrieving data. It's just a methodology. And we would probably be well served if we spent more time at these crypto conferences talking about blockchains at that level instead of the mumbo jumbo.
Yeah, for sure. And I think you're absolutely right. The jargon kind of often hides understanding. And when there's money to be made there, that can be a useful thing sometimes, because you can sort of promise the world without anyone really questioning you whether it's right or not.
You're right.
But yeah, interesting. Okay, let's definitely move on to blockchain gaming and talk about WAX, because I don't know how you feel about the space. I mean, you're talking about the kind of the trends you've seen in your journey so far. And I assume this is an area that you, well, obviously because of WAX, but are very sort of excited about into the future. But yeah, you talked about kind of your involvement with video game in-game items and your colleague who created the first marketplace. Give us the context for WAX here, what we've seen so far in the last cycle, because it is phenomenal. And where do you think we've kind of matured, what we might see over the next sort of couple of years, perhaps?
Yeah. So in fact, at the same time we were thinking about Tether, we thought about putting video game virtual items on blockchains, because we were running the largest marketplace in the world for trading those. And the problem at the time was the predominant blockchain was Bitcoin or its forks, and Bitcoin is pretty awful from a usability standpoint. 10-minute settlement times, expensive, blah, blah, blah. So it just didn't happen. And then after Ethereum, and my partners and I were the second biggest investors in the Ethereum blockchain. We were very interested in that, but we realized similar problems. It was when a very smart guy, who probably doesn't get as much credit as he should, named Dan Larimer, came up with a consensus mechanism, which is just the way blockchains validate transactions. He came up with one that was fast and cheap. And it was not a layer two. And, you know, we won't have time to talk about layer twos, but I don't think layer twos are very good. So Dan came up with that idea in 2017. And so we said, okay, he'll release that soon. Let's launch WAX. Let's start building WAX. And then we'll, you know, grab his consensus mechanism when he builds it. And it worked exactly as we had hoped. And so our thinking was this: having done video game virtual item trading at that point for over 15 years, we knew the struggles. The first struggle was most video game publishers didn't like us. Some even sued us. Most people who own virtual items would like to trade them, but the game companies restrict that. They'll ban your account if they know you traded them. And these items can be expensive, either in your time or in money you've paid to purchase them. So we thought, wouldn't it be nice if we could use blockchain technology to enhance the virtual item trading experience? So that was the kernel of the idea for WAX. And then we knew what we needed. We needed a wallet that was easy to use, and our thinking was you would sign in using standard OAuth mechanisms like your Facebook or your Google password, right? We're the first guys to do that with the wallet. We, using this wonderful consensus mechanism that Dan Larimer built, we could take a lot of the load off of the user around the annoying things you have to do when you transfer items on a blockchain. And so the users delegate to the wallet certain requirements that are difficult, which I love that about the consensus mechanism we use. And then we started talking to developers. And just like always happens in the video gaming world, the big video game companies poo-poo the latest new platform. And it's new indie devs who are like, I'll give it a try. And that's who came out. And so that would be 2017 onward. And it wasn't until 2020 that we convinced a branded company. I'd always wanted to trade tokenized versions of baseball cards on Wax. And we convinced a Topps trading card company to do that with us. I thought it would take about a month to sell like 10,000 NFTs. They weren't popular then. No one knew about them. And it only took like 24 hours. And that was, I think, April 2020. This was actually what I would call the start of this NFT boom. This is when everybody started going, whoa, like, look what just happened. You don't need to have virtual items in a video game, which can be expensive to build. You can literally just trade the virtual items, launch the virtual items, what we call NFTs, without any environment around them other than the blockchain. And so Wax quickly became very popular for that. And to give you a sense, I didn't look this morning, but like Ethereum might have a million transactions a day, Bitcoin roughly the same amount. Wax will have 20 to 25 million transactions a day. And that goes to show how much demand there is for people who want to do something enjoyable on a blockchain, in this case, trade virtual items. So we have, I don't know, 150 million NFTs on the Wax blockchain, 10 million plus active wallets. So to me, a purpose-built blockchain for NFT gaming and blockchain-based gaming wound up being successful. That is a good use case for a blockchain, and I think now Wax proved that.
Absolutely. It's pretty incredible. Those numbers are unbelievable. And I think two of the top games' most unique active wallets, Alien Worlds and Farmer's World, I think are up there on Wax. And it kind of reflects what you were saying about it's not a small group in some regards, but it's a group of fanatical people who really want to do this and are active all the time. It fits into your thesis of where we're going with this. Last cycle, we saw some more experiments. We saw games like Axie Infinity really capture attention across the world. This is such a global phenomenon. Gaming, as we always say, is the biggest entertainment industry in the world. We're trying to work out how we get the balance between fun, gameplay, and economies that incentivize the right things and allow players who maybe don't have any Web3 knowledge to come in and just enjoy the game. And then if they want to get wallet and earn items and trade, they can do that, but they don't have to. Do you think the space has matured? Now we are starting to see various games that have been building over the last few years come out, and they seem to be doing it much better and getting that right. It's early days, but where's your kind of thoughts on where we are as a space with that?
Yeah, I think the initial enthusiasm came a lot from it was a new thing. So people who were maybe bored with the stuff they've been doing on mobile games said, let me give this a try. And that led to a lot of initial adoption. And then a lot of the early play-to-earn game economics was around do an activity, get a token, and trade or sell the token. And people love rewards. Games have always known that. You get a reward for doing something. The problem with that was you had so much inflation in the reward tokens that they wound up having very little perceived value. And so people then got bored with the fact that, well, I'm getting all these tokens, but I can't do much with them. So demand just dried up right around the time that the post-Bitcoin halving cycle was starting to ebb as well. And then you had in 2022, all of the bankruptcies from the highly levered companies and then the frauds. And I think blockchain-based gaming and NFTs got caught up in all that. And what we will see now are people who've had several more years to think about how they can use a blockchain within a game to enhance that playing experience. I think that people have learned that, you know, the inflationary problem of having rewards that just spin out of control. It's like, you know, a country that just keeps printing money and to the point that no one values it. I think that is well understood and people are addressing it. And now there's just a massive amount of experimentation. And I think over the next 2 years, we're going to find the right combination of enjoyable game experience matched with some of the really terrific features of what blockchains allow you to do. And those will come together, and that will then create sort of a model for how video game developers should exploit blockchains when building their games. And it's going to take, I do think it's going to take some time because games are complex to begin with. And then you have just the challenges of blockchain, one of which, and it's no small thing, is blockchains are more difficult for people to use than like a traditional mobile game or a browser-based game or a PC game. And obviously, if usability is a problem, that's friction when it comes to adoption.
For sure, yeah. We're starting to see some games come out, as I say, that you almost wouldn't know they had any blockchain component to them unless you want to sort of go down that route, which is an interesting approach. With the gaming industry as a whole, there was a big kind of similar movement with the free-to-play era where a lot of people didn't like it, and that's kind of where mobile and casual gaming really found its feet, where you would spend money in the game to kind of level up and stuff. I'm trying to work out where the blockchain gaming sort of trend or revolution, whatever you want to call it, is going to fit into the market. I don't know if every game needs to have an in-game economy, especially big story-driven games like God of War and on PlayStation or whatever. Maybe doesn't fit there, but maybe somewhere later down the line, something like Grand Theft Auto, it might fit there because there's a different open world element, who knows. But do you think this sits on the side as kind of a category of gaming, or do you think it finds its way into all games eventually?
Well, first I'd say I think your hunch is right. It's not all games, right? Certain games are ideal for certain platforms, right? So for all the people who tried to port Flash games, browser-based Flash games, into a mobile experience, those things mostly failed, you know? And so every new platform that gamers harness has to be sort of figured out. And generally, you ultimately get native development that's specific to that platform. And those are the things that take off. And if you go back to, you know, the arcade game experience and then to PC and then to console and then back to PC and then to the little handhelds and then to mobile and now blockchain. Every single time a new platform comes about, the incumbent gamers in the old platforms poo-poo the new one. They generally claim those aren't real games. I've heard it every single time. Well, those aren't real games, right? Real games aren't played on a PC. It's just, you know, and then the browser-based guys came around and they said, oh, you know, real games aren't played on a mobile device. So, I think it takes native development, people who start with this is how the game is going to be working. I am wary about games, you hinted at it, that you can't even tell what the blockchain element is, then it may just be a marketing gimmick. You know, it may not even have a role. I mean, we could get into what is a blockchain because, you know, to me, a blockchain is not something that's permissioned. So you have so-called blockchains out there that are permissioned. You know, it's to me, that's just a database and it doesn't solve the problem that we were trying to solve at WAX, which is let people own assets and freely trade them. And once they acquire them, that's theirs. And the game publisher doesn't have a right to recapture them.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And it's good to be aware of that as well. There will definitely be, especially if the hype comes back, games that, similar to the dot-com boom, I guess, just sort of slap on a blockchain thing because it's the hype thing to do and it has no real use. But
definitely.
Yeah, yeah. That will always be the way. But interesting to look at native developers and getting, yeah, that's some smart thinking for sure. One thing I'm wrestling with, we're almost running out of time, which is a shame because I could talk to you for a long time about all this stuff. But one thing I'm wrestling with in this space as well is you look at platforms like Roblox and Fortnite, which really look like they're shaping up to be the new distribution platform. And we're going to see creators as game designers, feels like the next wave of kind of rock stars, almost. These people are making incredible games on these platforms. Those Roblox and Fortnite have economies within their games. They are deliberately kind of siloed, which seems to me to be a good thing in part, especially if there's younger users there at the moment, because you almost don't want a game to be tied to any sort of financial market up and downturn and volatility. You want it to be living in its own existence. And, you know, especially if you're young, you don't want to be making trading decisions and have to understand financial markets. So how do you think about those sorts of platforms that have got a lot of users and aren't tied to the crypto rails? They feel like that should also exist, you know?
Yeah, I think if you have an existing franchise, it's working great, your players like it, to shoehorn in a new platform and offer something that your players may not want, that wouldn't be a high priority for me. So I also think it's very difficult to find a game publisher who came of age in a given platform, console or, you know, PC, mobile, who went to the new platform and dominated that platform. It just almost never happens. They may acquire companies that are doing that, but they don't normally, the teams just aren't well suited. And this is true of most technology. The Web 1.0 guys all died or couldn't get to Web 2.0. The Web 2.0 guys couldn't get to mobile. A few did, but it was very hard. So I don't think blockchain gaming will be captured by existing big game publishers who are already in mobile or console or PC. I think it's going to come from indie developers. And yes, you are right. Like it has to make sense. Going back to the beginning of our conversation, what is it that a blockchain gives you an ability to do? Is that ability something useful to put into my game, right? That's what you have to decide. Is that useful? Certain games do very well with the trading economy, you know, CSGO, great. Now they have the benefit of Valve's Steam wallet and marketplace, right? So it works amazing, but Valve also thinks very carefully about the prices of these items and the secondary markets and, you know, and whatnot. So I think it is complex when you introduce tradable assets that can be bought and sold with real money into a game. It makes it more difficult for the game designer to figure out how to run that game long term without disrupting something or making it less fun to play.
Yeah, it's a difficult challenge, isn't it, to get that balance right and sort of satisfy everything. And
really hard. It's very hard. Because when you have a silo, you set all the prices, you set when something can be transferred, if at all. It's a highly controlled environment. But when you open it up, it's just like any country, right? When it reduces its trading barriers and it lets imports in, it can wreak havoc to the domestic economy. There's opportunities, but there's also a lot of risks. So these are complex things. And it's one reason why I think big game companies who have very valuable franchises move very slowly when they think about incorporating blockchain.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. They've got something to lose, where new developers have only got stuff to gain, really, haven't they? And I think thinking about these blockchain game economies like a little digital country with a digital GDP is an interesting way to see it come to life. Because
I think of them that way. I think of them as managed economies.
It's pretty fascinating stuff, for sure. There's so much genuine, really amazing wisdom in that episode. Thank you so much for sharing stuff. It's been brilliant. I want to make sure we talk about anything that you're really excited about and that you are working on at the moment that you'd like to talk about. So,
the last thing I would say is, you know, we're going to be into the halving when Bitcoin rewards for mining drops by 50%. That's April 2024. Traditionally, when that happens, there is a lot of excitement. And for various reasons, tokens start to trade a lot more. More people come back into the space who maybe left during the doldrums. And so we're 6 months or so from that. And this time next year, it usually takes around 6 months post-halving for things to get interesting. This time next year, I think you'll see some of the stuff people have been working on, development projects in the last couple of years when everything was kind of going sideways. Those will start to hit. And I think things like real world assets and that just means tokenizing real world assets and using the tokens as digital twins to trade the real world asset. I think that's a very attractive use case for blockchains. And people have had a lot of time to think about it now. And for me, I'm particularly interested in consumer products, tokenizing consumer products. We do that on Wax. That to me could be one of those bigger trends, you know, akin to like metaverse or NFTs or DeFi or exchange issued tokens, intelligent layers on blockchains, all these big developments in the blockchain space that caused a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of new businesses to launch. Real world assets could be something akin to that. I could just be hoping, but I think it makes sense. So that's something I'm looking out for in the next 12 months.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm noticing. Yeah, a lot of talk about real world assets, exactly how you've explained. And there's some great experiments on Wax and some stuff on Pokemon cards that seems to be picking up some steam. And it makes a lot of sense that you could trade things multiple times before maybe you collect the physical.
Yes.
Yeah, there's lots to dive into there as well, probably for another episode, sadly. But William, thank you so much. That was awesome. Really, really enjoyed having you on. Thank you for sharing all your knowledge, and I'd love to have you back on maybe in the future. But thanks so much.
All right, thank you.
So there we go. I'm sure you'll agree, a pretty awesome episode. Thank you to William for coming on. All of his links are in the show notes. Thank you all for listening as well, and your support. Do reach out. It's Luke_Franks on Twitter. Always like to hear what you think of the show. Appreciate your support, and see you for next week's episode.